and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, economist Gunnar Knapp. He's the director of UAA's Institute for Social and Economic Research, or ICER. This talk was recorded on Wednesday, December 7th. It was jointly hosted by ICER and Alaska Common Ground as a part of the partnership's ongoing initiative to educate the public about Alaska's fiscal future. This talk has been edited for broadcast. If you want to hear the full program, including a presentation from Alaska Common Ground Chair Cliff Grohl, you can find it on our website at alaskapublic.org. Throughout this presentation, you'll hear Gunnar Knapp refer to a couple of PowerPoint slides. The lecture stands really well on its own, but if you do want to follow along, we have those on our website. It's alaskapublic.org. Scroll down on the homepage until you see Addressing Alaskans. Without further ado, let's get to the lecture. Here's economist Gunnar Knapp on Alaska's fiscal future.
Well, why don't we go ahead and get started, everybody. My name is Gunnar Knapp. I'm the director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER, which is where you all are. Thanks very much for coming. I appreciate your interest and help today, because I hope you can help Cliff and me by giving us feedback on this presentation. I'd like to introduce Cliff Grohl. Cliff Grohl is the chair of a wonderful organization, Alaska Common Ground, and he'll tell you more about that organization, which basically works to promote informed discussion among Alaskans about issues that confront us as a state. And Cliff and I have planning a series of presentations around the state in the coming weeks and months to try to help Alaskans understand the fiscal situation that we're facing as a state. And the reason we scheduled this presentation today is kind of as a dry run, a practice for the talks that we've developed. So part of what we're trying to get is feedback on whether these whether these talks work, or whether they're confusing, or whether you think they're biased or wrong or whatever. So we very much appreciate your feedback, and we'll try to save a little time at the end. Or please feel free to contact either of us separately afterwards by phone or email and give us your comments, because we'd really appreciate them. We're going to divide this up into two parts. In the first part of the presentation, which is actually going to selfishly take up most of the time, I'll be talking, and my goal is to basically review the facts of Alaska's fiscal situation, just sort of what has been happening to our state savings, revenues, and spending, and why. And then in the last part of the hour, Cliff will be talking about options that we potentially have as a state for addressing our fiscal situation. So with that, I'll get started. Well, maybe I'll mention one other thing as a caveat. Many of you in the past have come to ICER for research presentations. And of course, that's what ICER does. It's mostly what we're about. We do research, and often you'll see presentations here where either people who work here or other people are presenting new research. Okay. Today, I'm not presenting new research. Anybody who is familiar with or who has sort of studied Alaska's fiscal situation will know everything that I've been talking about. This is not new. What I'm doing today is a different part of ICER's mission, which is to help educate the public about what existing research shows. Okay, so this is an attempt to. My goal is to figure out how to effectively convey information about a complex and important topic. So with no further ado, we'll get started. I want to give you a few words of introduction. My goal in this and the future presentations we'll be giving is to help Alaskans understand the facts of the state's fiscal situation in order to facilitate informed discussion as citizens and policymakers of the challenges we face and how to address them. So my goal is not, I emphasize it, is not to advocate for any particular policy, not to advocate that we you know, ought to do anything in response to this situation. That is a discussion which has certainly already started in the state and will be going on, and we can hear and see advocacy all around us. My goal, and I'm succeeding or failing to the extent that I can achieve this, is to stick to what everybody will agree as facts. Briefly about myself, I've been an economics professor here since 1981. I became the director of ICER 2 years ago. Many of you may know that I, you know, spent a lot of my career studying fish, but I've also been studying Alaska's economy for 33 years, and for many years I've taught a UAA course on the economy of Alaska. And in this course, I've tried to teach about the state's finances. This presentation, this material, is part of what I teach for that course. This is a complicated topic. The state of Alaska has many different kinds of savings, revenues, and expenditures. Understanding our fiscal situation is not easy. I've tried to make this presentation as easy and simple as I can, and yet pretty soon you're about to get pretty confused. It's a complex topic. So there's a lot of details I'm not going to cover. I'm trying to cover the big picture. But this fact that it's complicated is important because we face major issues, but it's kind of like that oil tax debate this summer. It's really confusing what our options are. It's confusing for everybody who's involved in it. And it's certainly confusing for me. And as I said before, I would appreciate your feedback on this presentation. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about data sources. I would emphasize to you folks and to all Alaskans, you do not need to rely on experts to tell you about the state's finances. All the data that I'm presenting here are on publicly available websites of state agencies.
Listeners, we have links to the publicly available reports Gunnar's about to tell you about. They're on our website at alaskapublic.org.
Okay. It's just that sometimes the data are not as easy to find or as you'd like. At the end of this presentation, I've listed websites where you can find all the data, as well as a lot more data. And where the data are from. So it's possible to educate yourselves as citizens about these data. Now, there are two particularly useful sources of information for understanding the state's fiscal situation. One is the so-called Revenue Sources Book, which the Alaska Department of Revenue produces, and another is the Legislative Finance Division's Fiscal Summaries. So very briefly about these. Every fall and every spring, the Alaska Department of Revenue puts out the so-called Revenue Sources Books. And in these books, and in particular in the fall books, they're the main ones, the spring one is sort of a shorter supplement, they provide very, very detailed data about all our sources of revenue. And they also include projections going out 10 years of how revenues will change, or what they're projecting, and what their projections are based on. And those projections are the basis for the official. They have to be taken into account by the legislature as they make their budget decisions. Now, the Legislative Finance Division puts out these two-page fiscal summaries. There's this page and another page which looks sort of like it. This is their attempt at the simplest possible summary of the state budget for legislators. But does it look simple? No, it doesn't look simple. It's very complicated. If you actually print this out, old people like me can't even read the print. And furthermore, what some of these rows mean are pretty complicated. So even their attempt to make it as simple as possible by summarizing it is pretty darn complicated. But you can, nevertheless, if you look at this a little bit, you'll see the main numbers. Now let's talk about some basic fiscal terminology. One thing that I always sort of have to remind students, but can confuse any of us, is that state budget and finance numbers are reported by fiscal year, not by calendar year. The state's fiscal year begins in on July 1st and ends on June 30th. So we are in fiscal year 2015, okay? And that began last June, and it will end next July, began last July 1st and will end next June 30th. So we're in the middle of fiscal year 2015. We do not yet, our budget was prepared for this fiscal year, was prepared last calendar year by last year's legislature, and they had assumptions, and now we have assumptions, we've got projections about how much money we're going to take in, but we're only halfway through the fiscal year. We don't actually know what our revenues are going to be this year. Far less do we know what they'll be next year. And so all the numbers on both our revenues and our spending for this fiscal year could change, right? Matter of fact, the legislature and the governor right now are talking about potentially changing some of the spending that had been planned for this year, particularly for capital projects. And of course, the revenues, they could still change wildly from what anybody's projecting. Another important point is that the state of Alaska has many different funds. Okay, a fund is, funds are different accounts of money or other financial assets that the state gets in different ways and are used for different purposes. Now, what most of the talk is about is the general fund. The general fund is the fund that pays for most of state government, including the university, including the state's contributions to schools, including the troopers, fish and game, and so on. But we have lots of other funds, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, the Statutory Budget Reserve Fund, the Permanent Fund, and lots of other kinds of funds. And those are not, we don't, we all those get money in special ways, and there are different rules about whether you can, you know, how the money is spent and whether you can even spend the money or not. Now, another thing is that state funds and revenues are either unrestricted or restricted. Unrestricted funds are funds that you can use any way you want to. You might think in your own, maybe in your own personal finances, you might think of, say, your wages as unrestricted funds, right? So and oil tax revenues are unrestricted funds for the state of Alaska. But we also have restricted funds, which you cannot use in any way you want, okay? And these restricted funds can be restricted either by law or by custom, okay? And so an example, from your personal life, maybe you've got this fund you put money in that you're saying, well, I'm saving for my kids' college, right? So I'm not going to take money out of that kids' college fund and use it to go on vacation, although I could legally, right? Something that's more restricted is you get a college scholarship, right? And you know, the scholars, they give you the scholarship. You can't say, well, I'm taking this money to go on vacation. No, it can only be applied to pay for college. Well, in the same way, the state has restricted funds like university tuition revenues or permanent fund earnings are something that most people wouldn't take kindly to it if the state just, you know, used it to build a road somewhere. But it could, the legislature could do that legally. On the other hand, there are other things like certain oil royalties and the permanent fund principal and federal highway grants that are restricted by law. So most of the conversation is about unrestricted revenues because those are the revenues that are easy to use. But these restricted revenues matter, particularly those that are only restricted by custom, because we could potentially change how we use them. And so most of what you're going to hear in me talking and in the public debate is about the uses of unrestricted general fund revenues. And here's, remember, how the Department of Revenue defines those. Revenue not restricted by the Constitution, state or federal law, trust or debt restrictions, or customary practice. This revenue is deposited into the state's unrestricted general fund, and most legislative and public debate over the budget each year centers on this category of revenue. That's unrestricted general fund revenue, and sometimes you'll see, they'll say UGF. That stands for unrestricted general fund. Okay, so, and that's what most of this presentation is about. But at the end of the presentation, if 4 hours from now, I'll get to talking about other funds and spending. They are very important to understanding the full picture of our finances and future options. But believe me, it's hard enough just to understand the unrestricted part before we go to that part. So now let's take an overview of Alaska's fiscal situation. Here is my attempt at the simplest possible overview, and this is what's on the handout that I have. And I'm going to sort of basically give you the 3-minute overview and then go back and spend 40 minutes trying to explain the details of that. This is our fiscal situation in fiscal year 2015, the one we're in. We are budgeted, our budget calls for us to spend $5.9 billion. That is $8,000 per Alaskan. The most recent revenue projections are that we will take in only $2.6 billion in unrestricted general fund revenues, or only $3,500 per Alaskan. That leaves us with a projected deficit of $3.4 billion, or a deficit of $4,500 per Alaskan. We have had cash savings at the start of the year of about $12.2 billion, or about $16,000 per Alaskan. At the projected future revenues that the Alaska Department of Revenue is projecting we'll have in the future, it would take us 7 years to deplete these revenues that we have in cash savings. And you might note that this projected deficit is 57% of our total state spending. So that's why, if that sounds pretty sobering, that's it is, and that's why there's a lot of interest and talk in this situation. Now, here are the same numbers showing going back a few years and projected ahead. I was just talking about the numbers for this current fiscal year that we're in. So trends going back to 2005, and I could have gone back earlier, I just arbitrarily stopped at 2005, and projections going forward. Now, and this is on the other side of the sheet of paper handout that I handed out. From 2005 to 2012, you see that our unrestricted general fund revenues exceeded our spending. So we were earning surpluses, okay? But beginning in FY13, our revenues began to fall. And projected revenues fell drastically in 2015, and so surpluses turned into deficits, okay? And of course, part of the reason was that our spending had grown so much. Now, this is what has really, really added to our problems. We had had several years in a row where oil prices were relatively stable at around $100 to $110 a barrel, and that was what people had been kind of expecting for this year. As a matter of fact, as recently as last spring, the Department of Revenue sort of projected, well, you know, in the future, oil prices are going to gradually rise. And instead, oil prices have fallen by half or more. Literally, it's as if they said, well, let's torture Alaskans in their fiscal year by making prices just fall and fall. Okay, and we haven't necessarily seen the drop in this fall in prices. Now, at the beginning of the year, prices were up around 110, right, or 105, and now they're down around 50. The average for the year, you know, you might hear somebody say, oh, oil prices are at $53 today. That doesn't mean the average for the year would be $53. The average will be the average of all the time since the beginning of the fiscal year. So let's say oil prices kept falling, the average for the year would still be higher than whatever the, you know, worst case number that they fall to. Now, it is basically this fall in oil prices that has led to this huge projected deficit this year, and I'll talk more about why that's happened. If we continued to spend, suppose we just said, well, we're going to keep on spending the $5.9 billion per year indefinitely because we really need all those things that we're spending on. Then if you assume that the Department of Revenue projects that the revenues are going to go back up, and I'll talk more about that, but even at their projections, we'd still be running substantial deficits into the indefinite future. Now, in the past, when we were earning surpluses, we saved the surpluses in many different funds. And we have been paying for these deficits that we're now running by taking money out of the two so-called cash saving funds that are the most accessible. These are called the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund and the Statutory Reserve Fund. And if you look back to 2005, we began to build these funds up when we were running surpluses, but now we've been drawing them down. We were building them up partly by the surpluses, but also because they were earning interest, okay? We now have about $12 billion as of the start of this fiscal year to pay for this year's and future deficits. If we continued to spend at this year's level, and if the Department of Revenue's projections prove accurate, we would deplete our cash savings in about 7 years. If we earn less than they're projecting, then we would deplete our cash savings sooner if we keep on spending at current levels. So that's the quick overview of our situation. Now, the debate is about, well, what do we do about that? But my goal is not to answer that question about what to do about it. My goal is simply to show you the situation. And now I want to go back into more of the details of this situation. And I'm going to talk mostly about state revenues and what's been going on with that, but I'm going to talk a little bit about state savings and other funds. Since the North Slope oil production began in the late 1970s, oil revenues have accounted for most of our unrestricted general fund revenues. And in recent years, oil revenues have provided about 90% of our unrestricted general fund revenues. So to pay for our state government, we've been hugely dependent on oil. The red is oil, and the blue is all other revenues. Let me just talk briefly about all other revenues. That's everything from liquor taxes to fish taxes to mining taxes, all those, you know, taxes. And together, they add up to 10% or less of what's been paying for state government. Now, we'll come back to this later. You'll see how drastically lower oil revenues are projected to be for this fiscal year that we're in, as well as next fiscal year. And I'll be talking about why that's so. You can see, if you look historically, that our oil revenues have fluctuated widely over time. And those of us who've been around for several decades, we remember this. And we remember times when oil prices went up and when things went down and everybody was sort of happy or gloomy. And we see this enormous jump in revenues that occurred after 2002 and now this enormous fall in revenues. So it's kind of a roller coaster. More than kind of. It's a giant roller coaster. Now, what has caused this fluctuation in our oil revenues? The most important factor has been the ups and downs in oil prices. Okay? Oil prices have been fluctuating widely over time, and they rose dramatically and conveniently right after we built a pipeline, and then they fell agonizingly in 1986, some of us recall that, and they rose dramatically starting around 2002, and they fell dramatically this year. Oil prices do that for reasons related to what happens in commodities markets. And in this graph, here's the same graph showing our revenues. And remember, the red is the oil revenues. And here's the trends plotted on the other axis in green of the oil price. And you can see clearly they're related. right? Clearly, our oil revenues have been, you know, oil prices have clearly been a major driving factor in what's happened to our revenues. But it is not a one-to-one relationship. There are other things going on that have also been affecting our oil revenues. One critical factor has been our oil production. Okay, and this red is our North Slope oil production. And as every Alaskan should know, we're still an important oil producer, but we are a fraction of what we used to be, barely a quarter of what our production was at its peak 25 years ago in 1988. Our production has fallen from 2 million barrels a day to just over 500,000 barrels a day. So we have a lot less oil to tax than we used to. And that's been a factor in our oil revenue trends over time. But if you really want to understand what's caused the changes over time in our oil revenues, and in particular, what's happened in FY15, you need to look at the details of the different kinds of our oil revenues and what they're based on. And particularly, you need to look at oil royalties and oil production taxes. Okay, so we have lots of different kinds of oil revenues. People talk about oil revenues, but actually, it's not one kind of oil revenue. There's many different kinds. And the two most important kinds are oil royalties and oil production taxes. The other biggest kinds are oil property taxes and corporate income taxes, and those are big, but they're just not as big as royalties and production taxes. So I want to talk about those in more detail. Now, what are oil royalties? Oil royalties are not taxes; they're payments that the oil companies made to the state for the right to lease and produce oil from our lands and sell that oil. We can't, those are contracts we made with the oil companies when they leased the oil. We can't go back in and say, we're changing your oil royalty so you pay more. No, it's fixed under contract. And for most of our oil leases, the royalties are calculated as 12.5% of the wellhead value of the oil production from the lease. 12.5% of the wellhead value. Well, what does that mean? The wellhead value is the estimated value of the oil when it comes out of the ground on the North Slope, or at the so-called wellhead. So it's the value of that oil where on the North Slope, as opposed to its value, you know, delivered in California or something of that sort. So, however, the oil is not sold on the North Slope. There's not a big gas station up there and you know, buyers come and, you know, pay at the pump up there, or pay at the wellhead. No, they pay in California. So to estimate, so we can't observe some price that people are paying there. Rather, the way the wellhead value is calculated is we observe the market value of the oil on the West Coast where most of it is sold, and then we subtract the cost of transporting the oil from the North Slope to the West Coast by pipeline and tankers. Okay? And so these transportation costs affect the wellhead value because the higher the transportation costs, the lower the wellhead value. And that's why there's a lot of debate about, you know, what actually are the transportation costs, and are the evil oil companies inflating their transportation costs so they'll have a lower wellhead value that they have to you know, pay taxes on. So there's been a lot of court cases and debate about that. Now, another thing about oil royalties is under the Constitution, 25% of the oil royalties must be deposited into the permanent fund. So only 75% of the oil royalties are unrestricted general fund revenues. Now, if you look at prices, and just for the past, you know, for the four most recent historical years and the two projected years, this year and this year, here's been the trend in the West Coast oil price. Okay? And these are the projections, and you see that they're projecting an average price for this year of $76. That's starting at $105 and going down to whatever, hopefully averaging $76 and not some lower average, okay? But the wellhead price is lower because you have to deduct these transportation costs. And then here's the trend in the wellhead value and West Coast value, which is the price times the volume of production. And that's gone down a little bit more because the production has gone down. Okay? And then here, graphed on two different axes, the red is the wellhead value, and you can see what happened to it, and the blue is the royalties.
What we're seeing here is a synced downtrend of both the wellhead value and the royalties. The two mirror each other.
Okay, and so you can see that the royalties have trended downward because they're a fixed fraction of the wellhead value. The royalties have trended down like the wellhead value, which is basically driven by the price. So royalties are primarily driven by what happens to the price. And so if the price of oil falls in half, as it has, then, you know, the royalties we're earning are half what they were. Now, let's now talk about production taxes, which are a lot more complicated. Unlike royalties, production taxes really are taxes that the state collects from oil companies over and above royalty payments. Unlike royalties, production taxes can be changed. We can say, oh, we're changing the way we tax you. In fact, we have made several significant changes to oil production taxes since North Slope oil production began. Several significant and many important but less significant. In the years 1977 to 2006, we had several versions of a tax that was referred to as the economic limit factor. In 2006, we adopted what was called the petroleum profits tax. And then in 2007, we adopted the so-called ACES tax law. A year ago, we implemented the so-called SB21 or MAPA tax law. And if you can remember way back to ancient horrible history, we had a huge debate in the state last year about whether or not we should keep this SB21 tax law or whether we should go back to the ACES tax. Remember that? Okay, that was a big debate. And you may remember that we ended up voting to keep SB21. So like it or hate it, that is our oil tax law that right now is affecting, you know, what we collect in production taxes. This tax, like the earlier ACES and petroleum profits tax laws, are based on companies' net profits. Okay, these are based on profits, not the total value. And this is an important difference between royalties and production taxes. Royalties, remember, are calculated based on the wellhead value, but production taxes are calculated on the company's net profits, which is technically referred to as the production tax value, after you subtract certain deductible costs from the wellhead value, including capital costs of production of the oil and operating costs. That becomes the tax base, the production tax value. That's what a tax rate is applied to. Now, one of the major differences between the ACES tax law, which was our former tax law, and the new tax law, SB21, is ACES was a progressive tax. And the higher the profits, the higher the rate at which companies were taxed on their production tax value. In contrast, SB21 or MAPA is a flat tax, a flat 35% tax on the production tax value. Okay, now a lot of people during the debate sort of said, well, at that time the profits per barrel in recent years, profits per barrel had been pretty high, and so the ACES tax rates were higher than the flat MAPA tax rate. So a lot of people sort of thought, well, this is a tax cut. Indeed, going to MAPA or SB21 definitely was a tax cut at higher profitability or higher prices. On the other hand, below a certain price, the flat SB21 tax rate was actually a higher tax rate than the MAPA. okay? And we're definitely, at the moment, over in the left-hand side of that. Now, there are many other important differences between these taxes that also affected how much revenue they would be collecting this year, you know, if one or the other was in place, or how much they might collect in the future. And so there's a lot of other things in that debate, which you remember were talked about. And so the, you know, sort of, if you're interested in the question, which tax would get you more money, you have to look at these other things, such as the kind of credits the laws provided for, whether they treat, one of the laws treated production differently, depending on where it was from, and minimum tax provisions and so on. All those things are important. But my purpose is not to debate which tax is better or not, but merely to remind you how this tax law works. Here is probably the most important thing to understand about what's happened. Remember this graph we looked at before when we were talking about royalties? Here's the West, what's happened to the West Coast value. Okay? And remember, here's what happened to the wellhead value that the royalties are based on. Well, here has been the trend in the costs that producers can deduct from the wellhead value to calculate the production tax value that they're based on. And these costs have been rising, actually rising quite dramatically. And at the same time, the wellhead value has been declining. And if you deduct rising costs from declining prices, you get this drastic decline in production tax value. So there's been this drastic decline in the tax base that we collect the production taxes from. And that drastic decline in production tax value was the main factor contributing to this drastic decline in production taxes that is forecast for this year and next year.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with economist Gunnar Knapp of UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research. Today's topic is Alaska's fiscal future, especially in the wake of plummeting oil prices. All the numbers and information referenced in this program are available on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just scroll down until you see the link to today's program on the homepage. This panel was jointly hosted by Alaska Common Ground and ICER. It was recorded January 7th.
Now, there have been other factors that have also played a role in the decline in production taxes. If we look back compared with, say 5 years ago, the companies are paying a lower tax rate. It was a lower tax rate, would have been a lower tax rate if we'd kept ACEs because of the progressivity. It's a lower tax rate because the 35% flat SB21 rate is lower than the higher ACEs rate that was going on at that time. And also tax credits have increased. But the point I want to make is that the change from ACEs to SB21 is not the main reason that our oil revenues have fallen so dramatically. The main reason was the tax base, the production tax value, declined so drastically. And also at the very current, very low oil prices, SB21 was not a tax cut. Now, I don't want to, again, revisit this issue of SB21 versus ACEs. The fact is, whether you love or hate ACEs, it is our tax law, and this is what's happened, at least for this year. Now, the Department of Revenue is projecting that our oil revenues and unrestricted general fund revenues are going to rebound significantly beginning in 2017. What are those projections based on, and how reliable are they? Well, the most important factor in the Department of Revenue's projections are what they're assuming about future oil prices. That's the most important factor. There are many other things that go into how they make these projections. And they all matter. What they have to make projections about future oil production and about future costs, which are going to be deducted, and future credits and all that stuff. But the most important factor is what they assume about future oil prices. And this is what they are assuming about future oil prices. That they're going to go down this year they're going to average much lower this year and even lower in 2016. But then starting in FY 2017, the prices are going to go back up, pretty significantly. But predicting oil prices is extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult. Now, if you go read the literature on what most of the so-called experts are saying about what's going on with world oil prices, they say, well, what's going on is that oil prices have fallen so drastically this year because oil production worldwide, like because of shale production in the US and other things, has grown so rapidly that supply now exceeds demand. And unlike in the past, Saudi Arabia said, well, we're not going to reduce our production to keep world supply low so that oil prices will stay high. The heck with that. We're going to let oil prices fall until our competition gets squeezed out. And then people think, well, if you've listened to the economic news over the past week, the economic news is that world economic growth is slowing, and Europe's going into recession, and China's slowing down, and so on. And this could make things worse by reducing demand. So most of the so-called experts say, well, oil prices won't rebound until the higher cost producers, like the US shale oil producers and the Canadian producers and the Alaska producers, reduce production because it isn't profitable enough to reduce the excess supply that has dragged prices down. So the conventional wisdom is that at some point, the new conventional wisdom, you know, as opposed to the conventional wisdom 5 months ago, is that oil prices are down for these reasons, and at some point, they're going to rise again once we squeeze out these high-cost producers and productions has declined enough so demand and supply are lined up. But remember that none of these experts predicted that oil prices would fall so dramatically this year. All these people that we look to say what's going to happen next year, none of them told us that what is happening would happen. So we might wonder how much expertise they really have. The truth is that no one knows what will happen with oil prices in the future. And they could rise to $120 a month from now. We can dream up scenarios that would cause that. Okay? But they could fall to $30 a month from now. We can also dream up scenarios that would cause that. We just don't know. We can think certain things are more likely or less likely. Now, with all due respect to the people at the Department of Revenue, who are wonderful people and very competent and work very hard and take their task of predicting prices very seriously, they don't know either. And here is, as proof that they don't know, here's what their projections have been of oil prices in the past.
The graph shown here is a mess of squiggly lines showing oil price projections versus actual prices. And the big takeaway is that we are not very good at predicting fluctuations in oil price.
Okay, and you can see every year, the red is what actually happened to prices. Okay, and you can see every year what they predicted looking out into the future. And you can see that usually they predicted that the future would be sort of like what the price was at that time. And of course, it's been wildly off because it was really impossible to predict all these things that have happened. And mostly because they haven't been able to accurately predict future prices, they've also not been able to accurately predict future revenues. Okay, and these are mainly driven by past price predictions. These are what they have predicted in the past for our future revenues. And here's you know, the most recent prediction for our future revenues. And my point, again, is not in any way to make fun of those hardworking people with an impossible job, but to say we just don't know. We do not know with reliability about what will happen. So, we can't assume that these projections are going to be correct. Now, because they come out and they are the official projections, they have a certain magical quality. We want to believe them, right? We want to think that's the future. And there's a tendency to think, well, you know, this is what they're going to be. And we make these long-term plans and so on. But we can't assume that. The future revenues could be significantly higher or lower than these projections. And since, remember, this says, well, how long do we have before we deplete our savings? This is based on these assumptions about future revenues. Okay, but they're only as true as those assumptions. So we could end up depleting, we could end up having our savings, if revenues come in higher, they could last a lot longer. Or if revenues come in lower, they could last a lot shorter time. Yeah?
Someone in the audience asks if the state has ever considered using hedging tactics to mitigate the state's risk of stark fluctuations in revenue.
There's been discussion about that, but it's never been seriously, there's been talk about it, but it's never been seriously debated, and perhaps that will happen in the future. He's talking about the possibility, you know, if you're in business, this kind of uncertainty can kill you. So what you can do is, if you're some kind of producers or some commodities will buy or sell oil on futures contracts that they have some certainty about what they're actually going to be paying in the future. And people talked about, well, could the state do that? Well, maybe it could. You know, another part of the projections that I didn't mention is the what's going to happen to production, right? And so that's another big uncertainty, and that adds to the uncertainty about what this looks like. Now, what about state spending? Well, I'm going to spend a lot less time on this, simply because I'm kind of running out of time, and also because I didn't have enough time to prepare. But you can divide state spending into the operating budget and the capital budget. And then the Legislative Finance Agency also further divides state spending in what they call agency operations and statewide operations. So agency operations are spending by particular agencies, like the University of Alaska is an agency, or Fish and Game is an agency. And each of these agencies has a budget. And if you add up the budgets for all the different individual departments, that's the agency operations budget. But there's also certain things that aren't really specifically attributable to any particular department, and they call those statewide operations. And these include debt service payments that the state has, or retirement payment obligations, those kind of things. These are actually some graphs that were prepared by the Legislative Finance Agency that looked at the long-term view since 1974 about what has happened to our spending. And you can see that what's happened over the past 10 years, and their numbers went up to the FY 2015 budget. Yeah, the agency operations part increased dramatically in this period since 2005. What we spent on all the different agencies, the University, Fish and Game, but particularly the growth occurred, remind me, Cliff, in the education budget and the health and social services budget. Those were the biggest drivers. And third was?
Three biggest, K-12, Medicaid, and retirement assistance.
Yeah, but among the, and the university is right in there as, one of the top ones. But all these agencies, their budgets grew very rapidly. That's the dark blue. But then you also see that there began to be big payments in this period since 2005 in the so-called statewide operations budget. Okay, and this came from several things. One was we realized we had a problem with unfunded retirement liabilities, that we hadn't been putting enough money into ensuring that I retire soon in splendor, and we had to save more money. We had obligations we had to make to make sure that our pension funds would have enough money in them. And there was also debt service and other kinds of things. So these statewide operations spending really grew. And then the yellow is the capital spending. And you can see that historically we've spent a lot of money on capital spending when oil revenues have gone up. We tend to spend a lot of money on capital spending, and we really squeeze the capital budgets when things are low. So the net effect of all these things was, even though we had this huge increase in revenues, shown in the green, our spending went up really rapidly, And so even though we have hugely more money than we did 10 years ago, we also have a hugely greater budget, and that's why we have this deficit. But you might say, I'd say this graph is a little bit misleading, because it's looking back to 1975, and you look at this and you say, my God, that those irresponsible Alaskans and legislators and governor and so on, look at this out of control growth in the budget. But you have to remember, our population has grown dramatically over that period of time. And there's also been very significant inflation. Everything that state government buys costs more. Okay, and if you adjust, let's first just adjust for inflation. In terms of the buying power of what the state spent, we see that the actual sort of, in terms of what we're spending, in terms of what it could buy, in the, you know, in our glory years of a few years ago, we were actually spending about the same as the glory years when I first arrived in Alaska in 1981, which was another time we were flush with oil revenues. Okay? But that's just adjusting for inflation. If we also adjust for the increase in Alaska's population, and we express the adjusted for inflation and adjusted for the growth in population in terms of per capita dollars, we see that on a per capita basis, our spending for agency operations in particular is actually lower than it was in the 1980s. This, I'm going to suggest, is why, even though our budget numbers are so high, we don't actually feel as rich. Or even, you know, a few years ago, didn't feel as rich as those of us who were here in the early 80s maybe felt. And money seems harder to come by, yeah? And you can see that one way you could interpret the growth in the operating budget is that all we did in these past 10 years was make up for this long, painful squeeze in per capita spending that occurred from the early 80s to the late 1990s. Okay, so you can debate that or interpret it. Well, I want to finish up. Alaska's fiscal challenge. I say this is our fiscal challenge. Unless we are very lucky and oil prices rise dramatically and unexpectedly, we are not going to be able to continue for more than a few years with business as usual revenues and spending. And by business as usual, I mean depending on the same sources of revenue and spending money in the same ways and the same amounts. If we go on with business as usual, we would, unless we're very lucky, deplete our savings within a few years and be forced, because we wouldn't have any other choice, to either cut spending, raise new revenues, or use other funds. And how soon might that happen? If you go by the Department of Revenue's revenue projections, it could happen when our first graders today are eighth graders. So if you care about your kids' education, if you got a first grader, this could happen when your kid's an eighth grader. But it could happen much sooner. Now, we have a lot of money in savings. We have $12 billion in savings. So we could continue with business as usual for a few more years. We could keep spending the same amount and just draw down our savings. But there are arguments, and I'm not going to necessarily endorse these, but I'm saying there are arguments for acting immediately to address our fiscal challenge, and here are some of them. If we spend our savings now, it's like same as in your personal finances. If you suddenly you lose your job, you say, well, I can keep on living on my savings, but maybe you want to adjust things, because if you don't, there's a chance a few years from now you'll wish you had. You say, man, I could really, if only I'd saved that money because I really need it now. Second, our cash savings earn interest, more than $1 billion in FY14. And the more we draw down our savings, the less we're going to have in those interest earnings. If we deplete $12 billion in savings, we'll have $1 billion a year less in annual revenue when those $12 billion are gone. Our credit rating and cost of borrowing are affected by whether rating agencies think we have our finances under control, and business confidence and willingness to invest is affected by whether businesses think we have our finances under control. So that's why we in Alaska are now beginning a major and critical debate about how and how quickly we should address our fiscal challenge by either cutting spending, raising revenues, or potentially using other funds. And as Cliff's going to talk about, none of these options are popular. None of these options are popular, and it would be very difficult to fully address the challenge through any one of these options if you keep in mind that our deficit this year amounts to $4,500 per Alaskan. I want to leave you with two final thoughts. The fiscal challenge isn't our only challenge we face as Alaskans. We also face what I call our economic challenge and our social challenge. The economic challenge is how do we develop our economy and create jobs for Alaskans, jobs and income. And our social challenge is how do we make our state a better place and improve our lives. These things matter a lot. They really matter. Our fiscal, economic, and social challenges are interrelated. If we cut our spending or tax and take away a lot of people's money through taxes or take away dividends, it could harm our economy. It could harm services which matter to Alaskans. So if we could harm make our economic challenge harder by solving our fiscal challenge, okay? But this is the important point. A lot of people are out there making arguments which are really relate to our economic challenge. They say if we only did X, it would create jobs. Or if we only did this, it would make people in Alaska healthier. Or if we only did this and had better schools and invested in our children, they would have a better life and a better future. But those may all be good things and very desirable in terms of our economic challenge or our social challenge, but they don't by themselves solve our fiscal challenge. You don't solve your fiscal challenge unless you do things that either add to your revenues or cut your costs. And so you might say, well, we ought to do X so we could grow our economy and grow, you know, our population. Well, that might increase our revenues, but only if we have, you know, sort of ways that we get more taxes as a result of doing that. But it could also increase our costs. So you don't solve the fiscal challenge unless you come up with more revenues or reduce costs. And with that, I think I'm going to stop. I was going to talk about for another 6 hours about the other funds, but I've gone way over my time. So now I'd like to give Cliff the remaining 3 minutes to go on to the next part of this topic.
There you go. All right. Hi, I'm Cliff Groh, Chair of Alaska Common Ground. As Gunnar said, we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that has been around for about 20 years and tries to get Alaskans to understand Alaska's most complicated and important problems better, and to maybe even reach consensus or common ground about them. And I've been on the board of directors about 20 years and became chair last May. Okay, very briefly, I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I helped create the permanent dividend as a legislative assistant in 1982. I'm the author or co-author of 4 chapters and academic books about the permanent dividend. I'm a former special assistant to the Alaska Commissioner of Revenue. I was a delegate to the Conference of Alaskans in 2004. This is where the disclosure part comes in. I plead guilty to being a lawyer, and for almost 30 years, in November, I make that. So, I've given a number of clients some bad news, discussed unpleasant, ugly options. So here's a set for you. There's a whole bunch of ways in particular or detail that Alaska could address this. They all boil down to 4, and really if you think about it, probably boiled down to 5, and really if you think about it, really only 4. So I'm not gonna go through every one of them of all the particular details, but there's using up the easily spendable savings, there's reducing spending, there's borrowing, at least for a while, there's raising revenues, and there's tapping into funds not traditionally or mainly used in the regular budget. I'm going to have a few points about each one of these. Easily spendable savings, as Gunnar said, The latest figures as of December 31st was there's $3.14 billion in the statutory budget reserve and almost $11 billion in the constitutional budget reserve. That money is the sort of the biggest pots of easy spendable money. Let's talk about the budget, because a lot of people are talking about cutting the budget. I think there will be a big push in the upcoming legislative session to do that. So I want to make a few points about it. Number one, it's clear by every measure that Alaska is number one per capita in spending among the states, and traditionally has been. Number two, the three biggest parts of the budget, roughly two-thirds of the total, are K through 12 education, Medicaid, and retirement assistance. Despite what you might read in the comment sections on the internet, you'll notice that legislative salaries, legislative staff salaries, and the Anchorage Legislative Building are actually not on the list of the three biggest cost items in the budget. The capital budget is only about 10% of the total budget. And when I say the total budget, I mean, as Gunner did, the unrestricted general fund, which is what usually people mean when they talk about the budget in Alaska. And then how you cut the budget makes a difference. There's some talk of targeted cuts to the budget, aiming at particular elements or particular cost items. And some people talk about, hey, Cliff, it's too complicated and too politically difficult to get into individual decisions about cutting the budget. Let's just have an across-the-board budget, a budget cut. Some people said last summer 25%. Now, some people, I guess, since they wanted 25% budget cut last summer, they want higher this year. And as one person once told me recently, Cliff, it doesn't really matter how you cut the budget. And that struck me as, if you're on the business end of the budget cut, probably not quite the same way you feel about it. But I do think there are different effects of whether you have targeted or across-the-board budget cuts. Okay, I only have one question on borrowing, which seems to be getting more and more popular among certain quarters in Alaska. If you borrow the money, how do you pay it back? So I want everybody to think about that. When you hear all these discussions that I think you're going to hear over the next 3 months about pension obligation bonds or some people who apparently are really whiz-bang investors, and I'm a little surprised, as was said earlier, they're not on their yacht right now. They sort of suggest, if you just borrow money against the permanent fund and let me run it, I can make more money for the state. I want you to think carefully about that and scrutinize it. I'm not going to have a detailed list of pros and cons, but that would be one point I make. Think about that carefully. Now let's talk about raising revenues. As I told my wife this morning, I'm going to let somebody else in this room figure out how much every Alaskan, how much marijuana every Alaskan have to smoke to individually make up the budget deficit that way alone. So that's an assignment here. Somebody else can volunteer for that and let Gunner know when I stop talking which one who's volunteering for that. But as Gunner said, the projected deficit in the current fiscal year, we're expecting more than $4,500 per Alaskan. So I went to Scott Goldsmith, who I guess is not here today, and I said, hey, Scott, let's compare that to other places. So he came up and he said, well, Cliff, and the United States Department of Commerce said in 2010, he told me a couple months ago, the combined state sales and state income tax per capita for the U.S. as a whole averaged $1,812. So one way to think about it is that Alaskans have for decades been the lowest tax people in the United States. And to make up the budget deficit, we just have to go to twice the national average. And so that's one way of thinking about that. Actually, more than twice the national average, as you can see. I think an important question that I urge everybody to think about, and it's one of the most important questions in Alaska, and not easily answered in the law, can't answer by the law itself, is what is the permanent fund for? And as someone who's researched this question and written about it, the answer that I give is that for every Alaskan and every generation of Alaskans to figure out for themselves, because there's not a simple, clear question or clear answer to that in history or the law. Gunner has talked a lot about finance, economics, and you hear a lot about sort of accounting questions of moving money around. But a lot of this entire discussion about Alaska's fiscal challenge is not really solely about economics, finance, or accounting matters. The most important parts, in a lot of ways, are psychological, political, and philosophical. Psychological in the sense that a lot of people have thought for decades, hey, Alaska's a rich state. And so it's hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around the fact that Alaska has the most structurally imbalanced fiscal system in the United States, of any state in the United States. and that, as recent events have shown, the idea of Alaska being a rich state is not quite a simple answer. So, or a simple mantra to just chant and everything turns out all right. And I think it's important to think about those three P's, psychology, politics, and philosophy, in thinking about various steps you could take to address this. As you can tell, but given time, I'm not going to run through every dollar estimate on income tax, sales tax, or favorite of some people I would think around the room, lotteries. I'll let somebody else figure out, go through that, and I will write that up and post that. But I want you to think about some questions to consider that I think are very important questions in how you come out about the best way to address the fiscal challenge we have today. The first question is one, it's very important to get this right. I'm not asking how long you've lived in Alaska. It's a simple, objective, quantifiable, knowable answer. I'm asking a psychological, internal, subjective question. How long do you live in Alaska? And I'll pose some paradigms or opposite cases to get people to think about this. If, as Gunnar suggested, you were a person who intends to live in Alaska until you die, and you're 28 years old and you have two little kids, one who's just started school and one is going to start school in a couple of years, and you think they're going to go throughout the entire school district here in Alaska, you might be receptive to the idea of, hey, we're going to sacrifice today for the idea that by the time your child's in the 10th grade, the high school will be better. If, on the other hand, you're 60 years old, and I happen to know one 60-year-old real well, myself, you might, and the rest of this would not describe me, you're thinking, I've already bought my condo on the golf course in Palm Springs, and I'll be there in 2016. So this idea that I'm going to sacrifice to make the high school better in 2024 is not going to be quite what that second person might be quite so interested in. So that's an important first question for a lot of Alaskans in terms of thinking about this fiscal challenge. The second question is, what do you think the alternatives are? And for Alaska, for a long time, it was, what are we going to spend the surplus on? Which new project gets funded? Which new program can get started? Now, in this new, different environment, people have to think about what the alternatives are actually now. And I think it makes a big difference what your personal situation is. And it depends whether you think the choices between whether I get a $65,000 a year state job or an $85,000 a year state job, if I just wait a little longer, that's a different kind of thinking than if you think, well, the alternatives are, do I take a cut in permanent fund dividends versus actually vote for a politician that has promised to bring me a progressive income tax? And obviously, it depends how you answer that question, whether you're the father of eight children living in Shagaluk and you support your family through subsistence hunting and fishing versus whether you're the husband in a double income couple that lives on the upper hillside. And so that will obviously affect a lot of what you think the alternatives are. Do the alternatives change over time? And I mean this both historically, because when Gunnar and I go around and talk about this, one of the two most common questions I get is, Cliff, how come it can't be like Norway? You know, somebody says, they only produce 25% more oil than we have, and their savings account is about 15 times larger than ours. So my wife gave me permission to say this. When this question arose this morning, I said, hey, lady, you're an American woman under 65 years old. How come you're not a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader? Because that's sort of the same kind of relevance in terms of you're asking sort of the same sort of question. You have to think about all kinds of other relevant differences of why that answer is. And some people also say, why can't you be like Norway? You have to get in a time machine and go back to 1976 when Cliff had very vibrant brown hair and maybe even a big beard. You'd have to go back to a world in which Alaska was the beginning of the oil boom and we could make different decisions on saving more, spending less, taxing more, and making more money on the take in terms of maybe getting a higher royalty rates. As Gunnar talked about, those are set by contract long ago. And then the last question I want to leave you with in the more abbreviated presentation I have today, if the fiscal challenge is going to force some losses on Alaskans, by what principle or principles should those losses be allocated? And I think that's an important thing to think about, because this is not 1981 when I first went to work for the Alaska legislature, and there was no dream that could be too big, no plan that could be too grandiose, no proposal that was too wild, no idea that was too far out there. Now we're in a different world, and people need to think about if there are going to be losses, and I think there are going to be some, how do those get allocated, and by what principle or principles should that occur? So my presentation is really much more about questions than answers. I'll have a longer written one I'll post on the internet, which has all those, you know, more, like I said, boring details of cost estimates or financial revenue estimates on things like taxes or various other ways to do this.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with economist Gunnar Knapp of UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research. This talk was recorded on Wednesday, December 7th. It was jointly hosted by ICER and Alaska Common Ground. The hour you heard was edited for broadcast. If you'd like to hear the full lecture, check out our website at alaskapublic.org. You can also find links there to some of the publicly available fiscal reports you heard about in today's talk. Thanks for tuning in with us this week on Addressing Alaskans. Until next time, I'm your host and producer, Monica Gokey.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.